You know, this is confirmation that even the Pebble mine is too toxic for the Trump administration.
The EPA deals a potential blow to the proposed Pebble mine. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, January 26th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Aniak and Bethel residents weigh in on another gold mine proposal.
We want the strictest regulation with Donlin.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds narrowing blood vessels, and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart protected. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
In a surprise announcement today, the head of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency said the proposed Pebble mine may pose an unacceptable risk to Bristol Bay. A potential blow to the controversial project, EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt said the agency is suspending its effort to reverse an Obama-era proposal to put restrictions on the mine. The decision isn't final. EPA said Pebble Limited Partnership can still move forward with the permitting process for its gold and copper mine. Pebble submitted a permit application to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in December after the company reached a settlement with the Trump administration last spring. But in a statement, Pruitt said the Bristol Bay fisheries deserve protection. Pruitt said, quote, "It is my judgment at this time that any mining projects in the region likely pose a risk to the abundant natural resources that exist there," unquote. Pebble opponent Alana Hurley of the United Tribes of Bristol Bay called the announcement huge.
We are celebrating this decision in Bristol Bay today. This is confirmation that even the Pebble mine is too toxic for the Trump administration.
Governor Bill Walker also praised EPA's decision, saying in a statement he's conveyed to Pruitt his concerns about Pebble many times. Pebble spokesman Mike Heatwall says EPA's announcement doesn't change the company's plans to keep pushing ahead.
The EPA confirmed that we have the right to participate in the normal lawful permitting process under the Clean Water Act, and today's news doesn't change our approach.
EPA says it will continue gathering information on the mine's potential effect on Bristol Bay, including more opportunity for public comment. State regulators meet with the public in Anchorage tonight about the permits for another proposed gold mine, Donlin. The Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation has released two draft permits that tackle one of the mine's thorniest issues, how the company plans to dispose of chemicals like arsenic next to a river important to subsistence fishermen. KYUK's Teresa Katsourilis reports on what the public said at meetings in Bethel and Aniak.
The Donlin Gold Mine is going to produce a lot of trash. It'll suck thousands of gallons of water per minute out of the ground and use it, along with a chemical process involving cyanide, to help strip microscopic flecks of gold out of rock. That leaves a lot of ground-up rock behind. According to DEC engineer Tim Pylon, the mine will generate a literal mountain of it.
Where it's a valley now, they're going to turn it into a hill.
Contaminated water will drain from the mine pit or seep from its tailings, some of it tinged with chemicals like arsenic. And all of that waste needs somewhere to go. According to the DEC's draft permits, some of that waste is going to pour into Crooked Creek, a nearby waterway that teems with salmon in the summer. At peak production, the Donlin Gold Mine will dump up to 4,500 gallons of wastewater a minute into the creek, though it would have to be treated first. Members of the public in both Bethel and Aniak, who depend on the Kuskokwim River for food, did not trust the plan put forth by the state for the mine. Yvonne Waska and Kathy Hansen both spoke at the Bethel public meeting.
You're playing with our lives, sir. Our lives depend highly on the Tuscarora River.
I don't understand why we have to take the risk of losing our land for somebody else to make a lot of money.
Alan Nakanishi is a DEC engineer. He says that the Donlin Gold Mine's water treatment system would be world class, and that the DEC is imposing strict limits on the levels of certain chemicals, like arsenic, that the facility can release.
10 molecules out of a billion would be arsenic and the rest would be water. I mean, that's how low those values are.
Waste that's too dangerous to discharge will be contained on site. Any tailings exposed to the mine's cyanide, for instance, will be funneled into a large pond lined with thick plastic and then heavily monitored. Many local residents who spoke were skeptical about the monitoring, fearing that Donlin Gold Mine will mostly be self-monitoring. In other words, regulating itself. Antioch resident Dave Cannon is a former fish biologist. He just doesn't trust Donlin Gold to self-regulate. He thinks an accident will inevitably happen, and he sometimes suspects the permitting process is deliberately confusing.
It's been overwhelming for me, and I'm a professional biologist, to be honest with you. I know what went into the draft environmental impact statement, and it stood literally 13, 14 inches high.
Other community members put more faith in the company. Carl Morgan is a former state representative who's also from Antioch. He used to work for Donlin Gold and showed up to our interview wearing the company jacket. He thinks the mine is worth the risk.
We want the strictest regulation with Donlin. Yes, Mother Nature might do something, earthquake or something. You know, there's just, we can't guarantee nothing on Mother Nature.
But Morgan says unemployment in Antioch is severe.
There's nothing better than a paycheck instead of a handout for welfare. People that are against the mine, they don't see that.
The mine still has a long way to go before it's authorized. These are just two of dozens of permits that Donlin Gold still needs. The DEC is holding a final public meeting today and will accept written public comments on the permits until February 13th. I'm Teresa Kotsarilis.
Alaska's congressional delegation has asked Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke to exclude most of the state from his draft plan for offshore oil and gas leasing. Earlier this month, Zinke had proposed opening 14 of Alaska's 15 offshore planning areas, all but the North Aleutian Basin in Bristol Bay. In a joint letter today, Senators Lisa Murkowski and Dan Sullivan and Congressman Don Young praised Zinke for taking an inclusive approach to lease sales in Alaska, but the delegation wrote that its priority is to see leasing in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas and in Cook Inlet. The lawmakers asked Zinke not to hold lease sales in the remaining 11 planning areas off Alaska. Their letter delighted Austin Amasuk of Kowarik, the native nonprofit based in Nome.
Finally, you know, we spent years advocating for the Northern Bering Sea.
In December 2016, then-President Obama responded to pleas to protect that region by issuing an order that created the Northern Bering Sea Climate Resilience Area. President Trump rescinded the order in May. Amasuk was further dismayed to see the Bering Sea included in Zinke's draft proposed plan for oil leasing. Amasuk says it's a relief to have Senator Murkowski and the rest of the delegation reject the idea.
It certainly feels like a long time coming, and I'm very happy that she and the delegation have issued this letter.
Commercial fishermen also objected to opening the Gulf of Alaska and other areas to leasing. The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management is preparing a five-year plan for offshore lease sales nationwide. It has scheduled one public meeting on the plan in Alaska. It was postponed due to the government shutdown and is now set for February 21st in Anchorage. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, examining what worked and what didn't in the tsunami alert system.
So what we're investigating now is what happened to the second, third, and fourth messages that the National Weather Service sent out over NOAA Weather Radio.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Federal Subsistence Board is accepting applications through February 2nd to fill seats on the 10 Subsistence Regional Advisory Councils. Councils meet at least twice a year and provide critical advice to the board on subsistence management issues. Individuals may apply or nominate someone for membership. More at doi.gov/subsistence/regions or call 800-478-1456. This message is sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
The four Republican candidates for Alaska governor talked about party loyalty, sexual harassment, and federal overreach today. They met for the first candidate forum in Southeast Alaska at T.K. McGuire's restaurant in downtown Juneau. Former House Speaker Mike Chenault of Nikiski says his experience with both the legislature and in the construction industry have prepared him to be governor.
I've got the leadership background and knowing how the legislature works and how it should work with the governor. I also have a business background. I come from a family business for 35 years and know how to employ people.
Former Wasilla Senator Mike Dunleavy criticized Governor Bill Walker, a former Republican who is an independent now.
Have the last 3 years have been the best years in the history of the state? Absolutely not. We have so much to look forward to. We have so many opportunities. We can be developing so many of our resources and get ourselves out of this fiscal mix.
Anchorage business owner Scott Hawkins is making his first run for office. He says he would have three priorities as governor.
One is arresting the crime wave. Two is getting our fiscal house in order, which includes getting the dividend back to a formula-driven program. And three, turning this economy around.
Petersburg handyman Michael Sheldon also hasn't run for office before. He laid out a hard line on abortion.
I'm an old school Republican. I may be the new kid on a block, but I remember the days of old. I want to stop abortion in Alaska. We're killing 1,500 babies a year in Alaska, and that's got to stop. If I have to take executive action the first day of office, I'll do so. If I get in trouble for doing that, that's just fine.
Four of the five Republicans running for lieutenant governor also spoke. They include Anchorage Senator Kevin Meyer, former Wasilla Representative Lynn Gaddis, former Alaska National Guard Colonel Eddie Grunwald of Palmer, and Wasilla resident Stephen Wright, an Air Force veteran. All of the attendees criticized Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott's oversight of the House District 40 Democratic primary in 2016. Kodiak Senator Gary Stevens also is running for lieutenant governor but didn't attend. He cited a legislative ethics rule that lawmakers can't use state-funded travel to attend political events. He says that includes the forum, since the state paid for him to attend the legislative session. When a powerful 7.9 magnitude earthquake in the Gulf of Alaska hit early Tuesday morning, it sent a host of people and systems into motion. Tsunami sirens were blaring, and emergency alert system or EAS messages were broadcasting over radio and TV stations, but there were parts of the EAS that failed. Local, state, and federal officials are now working to sort out those kinks. KBBI's Aaron Bolton explains.
When the National Tsunami Warning Center in Palmer decided to issue Tuesday's tsunami warning, it had to get that message out to the public as fast as possible. The National Weather Service operates the center, and it passed the warning on through three primary systems. National Weather Service offices around the state broadcast the warning over weather radios. Those radios can activate EAS messages at radio and TV stations, but they can also set off tsunami sirens and alert those listening to them. The warning is also sent out through two internet-based systems. The first is called MNET, which stands for Emergency Management Network. The state contracts out for that service. And the other, known as IPAWS, or the Integrated Public Alert and Warning System, is run by the federal government. And both of these services are constantly listening for a signal from the Tsunami Warning Center.
The FEMA IPAWS system listens to that. Comlabs, who runs EMNET, listens to that feed as well. And it appears that there was a programming error in that link. So it said specifically, do not send it across EAS.
Brian Fisher is the chief of operations at the State Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. Fisher explains that MNET and IPAWS were supposed to pick up Tuesday's tsunami warning and send it across the emergency alert system. However, IPAWS didn't completely fail. It's also responsible for sending push notifications to cell phones.
So it said send it over the cell phone piece, which did work with the wireless emergency alert system, and it blocked it from going to EMNet and EAS.
That left one more method to initiate most EAS equipment, weather radios. When the tsunami warning was issued, National Weather Service offices in Juneau, Kodiak, and Anchorage took that message and broadcast it over those radios, triggering EAS equipment across southeast Alaska and in Kodiak. But there were some hiccups on the Kenai Peninsula. The National Weather Service in Anchorage says it transmitted four messages to weather radios, but only one made it.
So what we're investigating now is what happened to the second, third, and fourth messages that the National Weather Service sent out over NOAA weather radio.
Dennis Bookey is the co-chair of the Alaska State Emergency Communications Committee and is one of many people trying to sort things out.
We're pretty certain that the audio message, should you have been listening to NOAA weather radio, you'd have heard the whole thing. But there's electronic coding that gets inside that message that then triggers receivers at the broadcast and cable facilities that apparently didn't trigger them.
GCI and Homer successfully picked up and broadcast the lone message, but at KBBI, the signal wasn't clear enough for its system to decode, something the station is working to fix. KBBI's system can also be triggered by IPAWS and KSRM in Kenai, but KSRM General Manager Matt Wilson says it received nothing from the National Weather Service in Anchorage. Officials at every level of government are working to dissect the problem, and Alaska Senator Dan Sullivan expressed concern at a U.S. Senate Commerce Committee meeting Thursday, which happened to be holding a hearing on emergency alert systems.
Because if we can learn from this, I mean, fortunately there was no tsunami, but it was very scary for hundreds, if not thousands, of my constituents. It would be good to be able to learn from this so we can be ready next time.
And Bookey says an event with no actual threat like Tuesday's tsunami warning will be a great lesson because it's the best test the system could ever have.
We try our best every March to do that with our annual test, but because of regulations and a lot of variables at play, there's only so far we can go. So nothing could be more valuable than having a real event and to dissect into what did and didn't work.
Bookey adds that once the issues are diagnosed, changes will likely be made to the system. Reporting in Homer, I'm Aaron Bolton.
The abandoned boat that plagued Western Alaska for months is now at the bottom of the ocean. The U.S. Coast Guard assisted the state by performing an emergency scuttle of the FV Accutane yesterday, 3 miles outside of U.S. waters. The processor was abandoned in Unalaska in September following a disastrous fishing season in Bristol Bay, where the ship's owner went broke, the crew went unpaid, and its 160,000-pound haul of salmon was declared unfit for human consumption. The Alaska Department of Natural Resources took custody of the derelict vessel in mid-January. In a press release, the Coast Guard says the scuttle was warranted, quote, given the vessel's condition and the tumultuous Bering Sea maritime environment this time of year, end quote. It's unclear how the state funded the disposal. This week, the Unalaska City Council was informed that the DNR had asked them to help pay for the removal. But the state and Coast Guard sunk the FV Accutane before the city had come to an agreement.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The University of Alaska's founders knew that to build a great state, we would need a great university. Today, UA offers more than 400 degrees and certificates with campuses from Kotzebue to Ketchikan. They are leaders in Arctic and Alaska research and dedicated to direct hands-on teaching, whether online, in the classroom, or in the field. Greatness awaits you. See how the University of Alaska can help you achieve at alaska.edu/start here. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
Support for public radio comes from the communities we serve. Whether you give as an individual member or through your business, know that your contribution makes possible programming that informs, inspires, and entertains. We thank you for the role you play in your public radio station.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, the mystery of the Pink Pond.
In Juneau, snow and ice has temporarily cloaked an unusual but likely natural phenomenon that changed the color of a nearby pond. KTOO's Matt Miller went on a treacherous quest to find it.
Ooh, that's ice. That is probably the scariest sound I've ever heard. I'm on thin ice, really. I'm gingerly stepping on pond ice. Big mistake.
Kids, don't try this at home.
I'm staying along the edge of the pond, but I really don't know how thick the ice is.
I step on the vegetation.
It's just after the first big freeze and snowfall of the year in Juneau. I'm midway up the Herbert Glacier Trail, an undeveloped area on the edge of the backcountry about 30 miles north of town. I'm checking out reports of a pond that looks like it was just visited by French environmental artist Christo, or maybe somebody dumped a case of Pepto-Bismol. What caused that weird pink color? Juneau residents like Karen Hutton send me pictures of the pond before the snowfall, saying the unusual coloration was concentrated more at the back of the pond rather than right by the trail.
The reflection kind of screws things up a little bit because the texture that you're seeing is from the branches above it. It looked very wispy, but like it could have been particulate matter in water.
Local scientists suggest several possibilities for the pink or lavender color, but they said the only way to know for sure is to examine the water under a microscope. Jackie Timothy, Southeast Supervisor of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game's Habitat Division, told me her colleagues were curious too, but they weren't able to get out and collect any water samples, and that's why I was literally risking my life for science. Carrying empty plastic bottles and armed with some ice cracking tools, I head about 3 miles up the trail to find three ponds buried underneath several inches of ice and snow. The water I collected was not pink. Later, I learned that I was at the wrong set of ponds.
There are two benches along this trail.
Right.
You go way past the first bench.
Oh.
You get almost to the second bench, but not quite, but really close. It's the pond on your left.
Not only did I not go far enough down the trail, I also screwed up my role as a citizen scientist. Jackie Timothy of ADF&G reminded me that my sampling bottles should have been sterile. Still, I take my light yellow, mostly clear water samples to the Forest Service's Pacific Northwest Research Station in Juneau. Stream ecologist Rick Edwards and entomologist Elizabeth Graham use a microscope to look.
Just looks like normal sort of.
Yeah.
Algal flock with organic matter. I don't even see any.
Oh, there's someone moving through.
Oh, yeah?
There's a green guy just swam on by. Oh, no, I lost him.
All they see is some pond debris, a couple of little bugs commonly known as water boatmen, and a very energetic form of plankton called a copepod. So, what could have caused the pink color shown in the pictures? Possibilities include sulfur bacteria, blooms of algae called dinoflagellates, or salt-loving microalgae like what was found in Western Australia's Lake Hillier. Edwards refers to Hutton's wispy description as a possible indication of a fungus.
Long filamentous strands of something. And there are several microbes that grow in filaments. And they're, you know, obviously fungi, the hyphal threads are filaments. That's quite visible under a microscope if it were a fungus.
Edwards says a fluorescent marker dye used by hydrologists to track water flow in such a remote area is very, very unlikely. I was probably just too late. In addition to making it difficult to find the ponds, Edwards says the snowfall and freezing temperatures likely altered or ended any process that generated the pink color.
If it is a biological explanation, it's a microbe of some sort, in all likelihood. That's all controlled by temperature. It's possible that would have turned all that off and they would have died or were flushed out. On the other hand, there are things that grow in quite cool temperatures.
So the mystery of the pink pond will remain a mystery, at least for another warmer day.
It might pop up again when the ice melts, in which case we got to go out there and get a sample now.
For AK, I'm Matt Miller reporting in Juneau.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Gail and Daniel Jones from Willow. Gail grew up in Anchorage, while Daniel is originally from California. The couple owns and operates Jones's Alaskan Valley Nectar.
We make the handmade nectars and teas, all from wild-harvested local flowers, berries, herbs, roots, and mushrooms. We work with gardeners that grow for us. We have farms that grow for us. And then we wild-harvest.
Everything that we can pick and get time off to pick is done by ourselves. We work with local herbalists to create it. We work with farms that we work with. And we used to joke and say people that owed us money had to go out and pick. So little things like that.
We started we were a tea company, and we needed something to enhance our teas, and that's where the nectar started. We have over 100 teas, so the nectars aren't quite there yet, but it definitely matches up to every single one of the teas that we do, and they're all originals. Fireweed is from the flower blossoms and flower pollen that we harvest within the 200-mile radius. It has very high anti-inflammatories, and it is our local flower pollen. We also do the chaga mushroom from the birch tree. It's the highest antioxidant mushroom in the world. It's anti-cancer. It's building your immune system. We make that in a nectar form, a powder form, a tea form, different ways to intake natural resources.
If you've ever gone to a Walmart or a grocery store and gotten a jelly or jam off a shelf and read the ingredients and things that have to keep it preserved and not knowing if it's been there 3 or 4 years, and you have a product that you've created from the ground up, here in the valley that you're proud of, and nothing on the table here is older than a month old. That says something, that means something, and you stand behind your product.
Yeah, I get to be with my family, I harvest, I get to be outside all the time, different events, festivals, I do farmers markets, I have my own indoor market, downtown Anchorage, I do the downtown Anchorage market. I mean, I'm out there and it's fun. It's not, a lot of my friends will come up and they won't believe that it's like a real job. And I'm like, yeah, absolutely. It's great.
Gail and Daniel Jones live in Willow. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Matt Miller and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage, Teresa Katsarilis in Bethel, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Aaron Bolton in Homer, and Zoe Sobel in Unalaska. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. You can nominate your favorite teacher at bpteachers.com. The deadline is February 1st.
Find out how you can include a gift to your public radio station through estate planning. Ask your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more.
ACPE's Education Loan Refinance can save you money and give you just one bill for all your private, state, and federal loans. The Alaska Refinance Loan offers Alaska residents a 4.95% interest rate with no fees. You choose between a 5, 10, or 15-year plan. Go to acpe.alaska.gov/radio or call 1-800-441-2962. This message sponsored by Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education.
One of the greatest honors for a public media station is delivering on its promise to provide quality programming and news you can trust to the communities it serves. What you hear on air is the result of a dedicated team working together to bring you the best. It's a privilege to be a part of your day. Thank you for listening, for your feedback, and for your support. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.